Okay, this is Monday, May the 13th, 2002, and Gordon Cameron is here with Colin Bairstow, and we're talking about Yukon aviation history, and we're just looking at a photograph in Bob Cameron's album of a relatively young Clyde Wan on the left and on the right, an unidentified, again, taller man. And it looks like they're standing in front of a Fairchild, either a 71 or a 51. And Gordon's just been describing, talking about Clyde Wan.
Yeah. Well, Clyde came in and he brought, of course, promoted the first aircraft in the Yukon in 1928, and then they had a couple accidents and went broke, and then he came back in 1931, I believe it was, and started up again, and then they had another accident and killed a number of people, a couple of accidents, and so that was the end of it. But he made quite a mark for himself. He knocked the price of moving people and freight and mail and so on between Dawson and Whitehorse, which made the White Pass really come down in their price. And then he went to work in the mine at Atlin, and he came over to Whitehorse in 1943, I guess, 42-43. Bought up a few lots in town and built a service station. Then he went out on the highway and he built some log places at Morley River and Swift River, I guess, Morley River, and up north at Beaver Creek. And he was a real promoter. He couldn't run anything because people refused to work for him. I worked for him for a little while and then they'd quit because he was impossible to work with. But he was a great promoter, which he should have just promoted, built the places, and then walked out and collected the money from the bank sort of thing. But he didn't do that. As a result, he died of a heart attack very suddenly. And as I say, he wasn't that old.
We're looking at a picture of CFASF now, nose down in the bush.
Which is a 4EM Stearman.
Right.
Mail plane.
Right.
And George Simmons, and I used to know the fellow, the pilot's name, flew over from Carcross to Atlin, and they used to have great poker games and ace-away games in Whitehorse, and they'd play all night. And the next day they were going back to Carcross, and the pilot forgot to check his gas or gas up and ran out of fuel. That's just between about halfway between here and Carcross, and went into the trees, and that was it.
Any idea what happened to the wreckage?
Well, I'm not positive what happened to this one. I think Bob got bits and pieces of it, mm-hmm. And I think somebody was going to rebuild it outside.
Right.
I don't know if they ever did. Right. All they had was a stern post, pretty well. License when the Travel Air crashed.
So we're looking at a picture of Bob Dellert in a winter scene next to a canvas-covered front of a, looks like a
Carcross hangar.
A Carcross hangar in the background. Yeah. That would be a 71.
Yep. And he's the fellow that was the daily inspection engineer and with the White Pass on the Travel Air. And had changed the starter two or three times and didn't notice the cotter pin missing.
Right.
And
on the Travel Air. So this is in this picture we're looking at right now. He's looking at us, and in his left hand, what's he got in his left hand?
He's got what they call a blow pot.
Right.
Or a plumber's pot. They carry one or two in each aircraft, and that's how you preheat under a tent and preheated your engine before you start up in the real cold weather.
Now, he's wearing a ball cap on his head and a zip-up jacket and boots not particularly laced up. Yeah. It doesn't look like a really cold day to me.
No, I don't think it is.
So, but he might have had to heat up the engine anyway.
Oh, he might have, yeah.
So this is, it might be 10 below sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
could
so
be.
He's still usable. And this next picture, it's another 71.
Yeah. I think that's George Simmons, I'm not sure.
And there, somebody else has got their hands on the prop?
Hand swinging the propeller.
Is that the usual?
Battery's dead, I guess.
Okay. So now we're looking at a summertime picture in Carcross with...
three Anson's and a Fairchild 24.
So the first one is CFEHV is a... You say a...
It's an, what they called an Anson liner. It was fixed up for carrying passengers.
And you can tell because... How can you tell it's the liner as opposed to the next
one? Well, just because I happen to know the airplane.
Okay.
And the other one, FGM, was used for hauling freight mail. And EKK was a Fairchild bought by Pat Collison, who left Northern Airways and started his own operation with that Fairchild 24 in Dawson City.
Mm-hmm.
That other Anson's just used for parts, or spares.
So it looks like it's got some just military serials on it. You can read a 1-2, mm-hmm. telephone pole 7.
Yeah.
And that roundel,
they're all ex-Air Force.
Ex-RCAF?
Yep.
It looks like.
Yeah.
Now there was just a picture of the original White Pass hangar here, and it of course burnt up in the fire that destroyed the Blanca.
Yeah.
And where was the steamboat hangar, so-called, that...
Just a little north of the old hangar that burned up.
And when you arrived, was there anything left of the old White Pass hangar?
No, just a burnt mess of tubing and bits and pieces.
And how long?
Still smoking.
How long did it stay there, the mess?
Oh, gosh, I forget. I think they cleaned it up fairly soon. It happened 23rd, I think, of December. And I got here on the 15th of March the following year. And they cleaned it up within the next... once the snow left,
right.
And they cleaned it up because they were starting to work on the airport, enlarge it and so on.
And did that stuff go to the airport dump, or is it...
I think some of it did, yeah.
Yeah.
I think the frame and all that stuff went out to the airport dump.
Right. Which was directly across the runway?
Directly south, the south end of the runway, yeah.
Oh, okay, the general dump, okay.
Yeah.
So now we're looking at photos of the Loewing commuter, aka the duck, on land in Mayo.
And there had been a flood that year, and it was tied up right along the hotel on the side of in the street.
Mm-hmm.
And as it was an amphibian, it just floated there like a boat.
And Gordon McIntyre was telling you?
Gordon McIntyre was the, he was teaching school, I guess, at the time. Then he became the territorial agent.
In Mayo.
Mayo, and then he married a gal named Ruth Batty. And they, of course, had family, and I think they still live in Whitehorse. I think Gordon died. I'm not positive.
So we're just looking at the photo of the wreckage of CFXJ on the island at Dawson.
On the Klondike.
And you were just talking about the wreckage?
Yeah, the wreckage was there for quite a while, and it, of course, it stood out when people came in to land in the Dawson Airport, and they looked down and they saw this airplane crashed in the bush, and it was quite demoralizing. So Ernie Kubicek, the pilot, said, until that wreckage is removed or destroyed, I'm not going back anymore.
So
they burned it up.
Burned it up,
and then...
And there the remains
yep.
stayed?
That's it.
And until recently?
Yeah.
So the floats for which plane was that?
BLT, the big blank air cruiser.
And they were in which?
In the warehouse down on the river.
The White Pass warehouse.
Stored there, yeah.
And how big were they? You're saying?
Well, they were the biggest I'd ever seen.
Uh-huh.
I guess they were probably the biggest that were built at that time because the Airbus was a huge airplane.
Right.
Until later on they built floats, a couple of sets of floats for DC-3s.
Right. Looking at a picture of
Travelair 6000
CFBPV at Dawson, a color picture, yellow plane, and it was, what did you say it was called?
It was called the Jeep.
Because?
I don't know why. particularly, but they always refer to it as the Jeep. And that's the one that Vaughn Woods was in when the engine quit and he went into Fox Lake, just short of Fox Lake, killed himself, and Tom Mackay.
Okay, we're looking at CFDPM on...
Fleet Canuck.
Fleet Canuck?
Mm-hmm.
On ice?
It's on wheel on skis, yeah.
Right.
Just wheel them on.
And dog team pulling a small toboggan?
Yeah.
Or dog team?
I don't know where that is.
The caption suggests it's Ross River.
Ross River, yeah. Yeah, he's probably right there, George.
Right. And there's a color photo of the, I guess it's DPM, in front of a hangar. Which hangar would this be?
That was Steamboat.
Steamboat hangar.
Yeah.
And the plane in the background is OMP.
That was a Cessna 120.
Right.
Yeah. Brand new.
We're looking at CBs now, and there's a picture of CFFOW.
I think they were selling them for just under $7,000, and it cost them $9,000 to build them. So after they built a whole batch of them, they decided that enough was enough. That's Norm Hartnell and Bud Harbottle. They were all part of our group.
On Southern Hangar, the doors open and inside.
Stinson and the Aronca sedan.
Right.
And a company truck, and you can't see it right there, but it's white with flying service. We had a local sign painter paint it, and our motto below on the back door was "We cover the Yukon," but the stylized writing on there, it said, looked like "We love the Yukon," so we had trouble hiring a gal to work in the office, particularly if she was married. We hired one, and her husband says, "You're not going to work for those fellas. We love the Yukon." It's a Canuck that, or a Cornell that a fella bought.
CF.
War surplus, CFFON.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a miner, and he flew it up to Mayo. It had been in crates and storage for a long time. And I think he ended up with around 100 and some hours on it. And he brought it back in one time to me to renew the license. And I was checking it over, and I did a fabric test on it, and of course it failed completely. There was a lot of ringworm, and the fabric was in terrible shape. So I told him, I said, "All I can do is get you, I can get you a ferry permit. I can patch it up enough to get you a ferry permit, and you can ferry it out to Vancouver and have them recover it," and so on. "Oh, no, he didn't want to do that. How about buying it?" I said, "No, we've got no use for it." It had two full sets of instruments, fore and aft, and it had a blind flying hood in the back cockpit, and it was completely, fully equipped in a very low time, of course. 200 horse Ranger in the front. And he came back a day or two later, and he was really determined, and he was also very hungover. Been out on a real bender. And he said, "Come on, buy the airplane, buy it from me, make me an offer." I said, "Oh, you wouldn't be, anything I'd offer you'd be ridiculous. You wouldn't go for that." "Well," he says, "make me an offer." I said, $100. Oh, he just about passed out. Matter of fact, he went around beside the hangar and threw up. He was really sick. Then he went on downtown. He came back the next day. He says, "I'll take it." So we gave him $100, and we ended up with an airplane we had absolutely no use for. But I recovered it. And then my partners and I drew straws to see who was going to test fly it, and I ended up with a short straw, so I'd never flown one before. Borrowed a parachute in the Air Force, and I went out and did a couple of circuits, and then the other fellas flew it. And then we sold it to Eric Nielsen, who later became the Deputy Prime Minister of Canada. Sold it to him for $800. And then he sold it to Mo Grant. And then Mo Grant sold it to a fellow named Al. Can't remember his last name. Had an upholstery shop downtown. And he came up one day to me and asked if I'd renew the certificate of airworthiness. So I said, okay, so I started to check it out, and I looked at the engine, and I saw black streaks on the engine. So I checked real close at the identification plate, and I could see new rivets. And it suddenly dawned on me that they had a fire in the upholstery shop, and they had a spare engine for this airplane in a crate out on the back porch. And the place didn't burn right to the ground, but it was pretty badly burnt. And of course the engine was in on it, and the black streaks were from the water hitting the engine and making the black streaks on the side of the crankcase. So I said, well, you've changed the engine. No, he denied that. Thought I was an awful man for suggesting it. So I said, well, I'm not going to sign it out. So he flew it over to Atlin, and he asked Herman Peterson signed out. And he says, why wouldn't Cameron sign it out? He says, well, he claims that I changed the engine. I didn't. He says, I didn't. So Herman says, well, I'm not going to sign it out either. So he ended up selling the thing to Jim Howitt. He had Jim's Toy and Gift Shop down on Main Street. And he never knew how to fly, but he wanted the undercarriage because he wanted to make a combination houseboat and trailer. With this undercarriage, he was going to make it retract on the side of the houseboat, and he could tow it behind a car, and he could launch it and then fold the wheels up, be a boat. So he sold the engine, I don't know what word, and he sold the two instrument panels, and then took the rest of the airplane. As I say, it still didn't, only had 200 hours of that, and he threw it in the dump. Today, that airplane is worth a lot of money. Anyway, that was the end of C.F. Fairchild Cornell. It was what they call, the designation was an M62A3, which meant it had a modified spar strap on the bottom. Mm-hmm. So, and, go ahead. It was a nice airplane to fly. It was a fairly heavy airplane, so it wasn't overpowered, but.
Whereabouts was the dump at that point?
At that same place out on the Range Road it was then.
Right.
And dumped into the river there where Porter Creek comes out, I think, into the Yukon.
Right. Now, the miner prospector who apparently put a new motor on, why couldn't you certify the plane with new motor? Couldn't you just look at
well,
the motor?
Well, it wasn't the miner, it was the upholsterer.
Sorry, the upholsterer, pardon
yeah.
me.
Well, no, not through fire. No way that you could certify it. And also, it had to be, he'd switched identification tags, and of course, that's completely a no-no.
Right.
You can't do that.
Right.
But he thought he could get away with it. PA-12 Super Cruiser.
With
the company had White Horse Flying Services Limited, and when we amalgamated.
With Yukon Airways.
Yeah, with Yukon Airways, and then a fellow named Jock Patterson, who worked for Pan American Airways, he and I bought it. Mm-hmm. Actually, a little before that, the company decided they had no use for it, and they sold it to a chap, and I forget his name, and he took off in a crosswind up at Burwash Landing, the airstrip, and dove between the hangars and busted up. So Jock Patterson and I bought it and patched it up, rewelded the frame, and fixed it up and put it on floats. And then I sold my half out. I forget the fellow's name that bought it. And then the two of them sold it to an operator in Prince George. And the last we heard, they'd sunk the thing once and dragged it up. And last I saw it, it was sitting on the airstrip at Prince George looking rather derelict. This is Bob. Bobby Cameron.
Little Bob, about five, maybe.
Yeah, he was four or five. Yeah. The airplane we bought from Northern Airways.
CFBXH.
Yeah. And that's a Hiller 360 that we had on the topographical survey. And this is BXH, not in as good condition as there.
it looks to me like there's nothing there but the welded frame.
Yeah. Well, it caught fire at 6,000 feet. Norm Hartnell was flying it. And he dove it down. He thought maybe he could blow it out if he dove it down fast enough. And then he hit the lake real hard to see if he could splash it out. And he bounced right up onto the logs by the side of the canal road and got out just as the flames came down the side of the fuselage, and he just ran.
Now, this picture before, it's the Hiller
360.
Two Hiller 360s, I guess.
Yeah, a topographical survey.
And with CFBXH in the background.
Yeah, I forget what lake it's at. Somewhere north of Dawson.
Right. A mountain there. There's which two? Sorry, the.
Stinson.
Right.
Station wagon that's being
picked
up. Jock Patterson picked it up in his truck.
Mm-hmm.
And going by the old Fairchilds sitting on the shore of the lake.
Mm-hmm. Edge of the canal road.
Yeah. That's our Norseman. CFOBO. Beautiful airplane. Mark V. That's our first Beaver. FHA, the one that George was killed in.
Right. And where is this scene?
Right in Whitehorse, right down on the river.
So they're both...
Like the new hospital would be right over in here.
Just directly across the river.
Yeah.
Above the Norseman. And is that a usual sort of a cache of drums? It looks like a dozen or so.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There. Yeah, we use that for gassing up.
Right. And
hauling. We haul drums out of there, too. Different places.
And did you make any, did you do any work on the Norseman when you
I never did. I did it three circuits.
Mm-hmm.
George said he'd give me three circuits and I think see what it was like, so I enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he headed for the summer. I took off with this and Bud Harbottle
with your
for the summer.
Pointing at the Beaver FHA.
Yeah, that was 1951. And then we bought that from Loam Airways in Toronto.
L-O-M-E?
L-O-M-E.
Mm-hmm.
And it was number the 15.
The Beaver, yes.
Yeah, number 15. And CFFHA. And the number one was FHB. People keep asking us why yours was 15. Number one was FHB. Well, FHB was Frank Bullen. Frank H. Bullen was one of the design engineers. So they said, well, we'll give the registration in honor of him.
Right.
Then we bought a brand new one, paid $25,000 for that one. Bought a brand new one, paid $42,500.
Sorry.
On wheels and floats.
So you bought a second Beaver then?
Yep.
And that's CF?
GCY.
GCY.
Yeah.
So why did you buy a second one? You know, had a... You
well,
had
we... Yeah, we...
You had a Norseman.
No, we sold the Norseman. We bought it for $21,000, and we flew it for 200 hours, took a Lear T-30 radio out of it, and then sold it for $25,000. So we did pretty good. Sold it to Queen Charles Airlines in Vancouver.
But why sell it?
Well, because it wasn't really what we wanted. We just got it as a standby to get the contract with Beaver.
How did the Beaver and the Norseman compare for Whitehorse?
Well, the Beaver got off much faster, but it wouldn't pack the same load. The Norseman, we could pack actually 2,500 pounds,
mm-hmm.
2,000 normally.
Mm-hmm.
And the Beaver, you could only pack 1,100 pounds.
Right. And you're talking on wheels or
on floats?
On floats, right.
Yeah.
That's the usual way. Yeah.
Yeah.
It.
And
so you figured the payload was more useful with a Beaver?
And get in and out of smaller lakes and so on. The Norseman required, fairly good piece of water to land and take off. And now this was a Mark V, which was a very good performing airplane.
A Beaver.
The Norseman,
sorry, the
Mark
Norseman,
V,
yeah.
Had a 600 horse engine and a three-bladed prop.
Yeah.
The people in the town of Whitehorse didn't have much use for it because in the morning at 5 or 6 when George would take off, it would rattle every window in the place.
The Norseman.
Norseman, yeah.
And compared to the Beaver?
Oh, the Beaver was... It was a pussycat noise compared to the Norseman.
Was that just partly a function of the propeller?
Partly, and it was a lot bigger engine. The Beaver had a, what they call an R985, which is 450 horsepower Wasp Junior, and the Norseman had a 600 horse, which is an H Wasp, S3H, 3H1, actually. We put out one time. Now, this was in the search for George Milne, and that's the S-51 Sikorsky, which was search and rescue Air Force machine. And as I mentioned before, the pilot was Sam McGee. And he tried to land sideways on the road instead of in line with the road, and he, the crown, because of the crown of the road, he slipped backwards, and the tail end went into the bush, and it just whipped itself over upside down. And tore the blades off it and then set, caught fire. We came out. We were using that for gas caches for the search area. And I just landed when this happened, so we just ran up and put the fire out.
Okay, now switching the topic from the photo album now and looking at back to just more focusing on Whitehorse Flying Services and continuing on from where we were the last day. I'm just wondering, you described your facilities at the airport. You were in the old Yukon Southern hangar, I guess you were mentioning. I'm just wondering what you used for facilities on the riverfront. Do you just have, you just pulled up to the bank? Did you have a building down there, or?
Well, we had a little dock. And we were just sort of in the back eddy, from that gravel bar that's just below the bridge.
Oh, yes.
We're in a back eddy there, we're by the railroad track, and we had a little log shack. It'd be about 10 by 12, and it was a skid shack. We pulled it up there, and that was our office. We had a telephone in there, and that's where we brought our freight loads in, what little freight loads we had, and we could tie up two or three aircraft, four if we had to, bank of the river, and that was where we operated. Now then, of course, it was quite easy. Like on a north wind, you'd land on the curve on one float. Now you can't do that, of course, because the bridge is there. But other than that, you'd go down below, down by the refinery, turn around and come back upstream north with the normal wind being a south wind.
Was there one particular area or part of your service that was sort of the bread and butter for you that made you your money as an operation?
Not really. Well, the one year, the winter, of course, was always very, very quiet and very dead. In fact, one year I went to work in a body shop, and one of the pilots, Norm Hartnell, who went to fly out of Kitimat, and George and Bud just stayed and did the odd trip when anything came up. Then we had one winter, which was very good because they had that in the somewhere in the States, I guess it was. Anyway, they had hoof and mouth, you know, the
disease,
and they weren't allowed to ship any meat supplies up the coast through the States, so they had to come up inland, and so they brought it up by truck from Vancouver
to
Whitehorse.
To Whitehorse, okay.
And then we could fly it down to Tulsaqua, which was a mining operation there. I think it was copper, and lead, zinc. And so we could, anytime we could do one or two trips whenever the weather was good, because it was down south of Atlin, and you had to go in through the mountains, and that was very good. So that kept us solvent for that winter.
Okay, this is Side B, and Gordon Cameron and Colin Barrister were talking about Yukon aviation history, and we were just talking, Gordon was just talking about winters being slow times with Whitehorse Flying Services, but one winter they were kept steadier with flying meat into
Tulsaqua.
Into Tulsaqua.
That's right.
Was it just Tulsaqua you were flying the meat into? Or?
Yep, that's all. Yep.
There would have been no road into Skagway at the time.
Oh, no, no. No road in Skagway.
But they would have got their meat from a larger operator, or? So, So again, we're focusing. We're looking at the where I guess your business did come from, or was there any particular part of your business that was the bread and butter? And winters were slow months. What was the first sign of the awakening of business in the spring? What were the first sorts of?
Well, I was figuring on going into out of floats on the 24th of May. Mm-hmm. Everyone else was holiday, and we had to work and change over on the floats. But
would you do any late season ski work in April, May? Or?
Yeah, we did late the ski trip, which is always a little risky. In fact, what we did one year, we operated off the bay at this end of Lake LaBarge, and we'd have to truck things down to the lake, and then fly out of there. And then he'd radio when he was coming in, whoever was flying, and I'd run down with the truck and pick them up. And we did that because there was no snow left in the airport. And then we watched pretty close when the ice got really bad. Well, of course, out in the main lake was a lot of open water. Mm-hmm. But in the little bay there by that fan marker station, mm-hmm. it was usually pretty good.
And where would you be making your trips to?
Well, in those this one year, we were hauling different loads to Mayo.
Because?
The boats couldn't run, and there was no road. They were just constructing the road to the Mayo Road. Mm-hmm. And one trip we made, Bud Harbaugh and I made with a load of dynamite. And we took the dynamite caps with us. We're not supposed to carry them both together, but we put the dynamite caps under the seat. And we left, and we got between Selkirk and Mayo, and the weather was right down. We weren't going to be able to get into Mayo. So we came back, and we didn't have enough fuel to come all the way back to Whitehorse, so we had to land at Selkirk, and they've just got a grass and gravel strip, and there was no snow, and we were on great big plank skis. So we went ahead, and we landed. We didn't go very far. We stopped pretty short. But nothing happened, and then, of course, we stayed overnight at G.I. Cameron's, the Mounted Policeman, and came out early in the morning, and there was enough frost in the morning. Once we got it jiggled loose on the skis, we could take off in the frost. And,
what plane was that you were flying?
It was a Beaver. And did our trip in and landed on the river in Mayo, and it was getting a little dicey, although we had to stay right out in the middle of the river, because you get in close to shore and it's the ice gets pretty rotten. Anyway, worked out.
So that was one spring when you were supplying mail just before, in that time between when they could go in over snow, I guess, and
yep.
when the rivers
yep.
would open up. And then once you got wheels on,
We didn't do too much on wheels.
Or floats, I guess.
Yeah, we like to wait and get onto floats. We did, we fly on wheels, but of course that's the riskiest part.
Right.
On wheels, single engine aircraft in the country at the time, there are very few roads. And mind you, originally, you see, years ago when the White Pass first got into the flying business, they had airstrips every 20 miles between Whitehorse and Dawson. And they had a fellow named Happy LePage. And he'd go down in the winter. He had a cat, and he had a caboose. And half the caboose was for living, and the other half was he'd drive the cat in, keep it warm. And then he'd unhook it, and he'd go on down from here to Upper LaBarge. There was an airstrip there. And then from there to Fox Lake, there was an airstrip there. From there to Montague, I guess it was. Far end of Fox Lake?
Little Fox.
Oh, no, where
Brayburn.
Cinnamon, yeah. Brayburn strip.
Yeah.
And he'd roll that. These rollers. There were rollers at each set of the strips. And then from Brayburn to Montague, and Montague to Carmax, and Carmax to the Yukon Crossing to Stewart, and Stewart to, I think, Wounded Moose was another one, and McQuestion, Wounded Moose, and Dawson City. And they kept all those strips rolled, and we were flying, of course, on skis in the winter, so it worked very well.
So you would
rely on those as, would you use those strips in the wintertime?
If you had to, they weren't used commonly because a lot of them, there were nothing there at all. But Carmax was another one. I think I forgot to mention that. But Carmax, there was a town there, so we used that in the winter. And Selkirk, there was a town there. We used that. But
in the summertime, were the strips at all serviceable for wheels?
Yes, you could use them in the summertime for a long time. Then eventually the brush got growing up pretty good, so it was a little risky. There were high bushes around the place and so on. But you could still get in an emergency if you had to.
So on floats, then after May, you got your floats on the planes in May 24th, and this would be all your planes, or which planes would you be putting on floats?
Well, like we had Beaver and two Beavers mm-hmm. there at one time, and 180,
mm-hmm.
and those were the only planes we had on floats.
Right.
Well,
Cessna 180.
Yeah, Cessna 180.
And
one of the first 180s, and. Light, and it was a very good performer.
So you're flying on floats then in the summertime, and was there anything, was there a particular kind of business that was?
It was all charter,
right.
Charter flying, and we had the school on the airport, but that wasn't, we didn't do any float work at all.
Right.
We bought one of the first 180s and they came out, a very good performer, but they had, I came down one morning and I noticed that the propeller spinner seemed to be hanging down a little bit, and I checked, and the engine mounts were buckled. They were very weak engine mounts, and the engine was hanging down. So that was a bit of a problem, so I pulled the engine out, and they shipped us new mounts, reinforced mounts. And while the engine was out, it was tied to the bank, and some rather mean, miserable individual cut the ropes, and they came down in the morning, I came down and put the engine back in, and there was no airplane. And so I got a hold of George, we jumped in the Beaver and took off, and down, three or four miles downriver, it was stuck into the brush, and it buckled, bent up the aileron and the elevators and little things like that. Wasn't too bad. So then we had to find a local person with a riverboat and tow it up because there was no engine in the thing, and towed it back up for us. And however, we didn't find out who it was. We had a police check on it, but it was a pretty wild place in Whiskey Flats in those days. So we were right on the edge of Whiskey Flats. And other than that, it was fairly straightforward. We lost a door off the Norseman, thanks to a helpful passenger. A fellow thought he was being helpful. Instead of opening the man door to get in or out of it, it was a double door on one side which you could open up and roll in drums. And he pulled the pins on the whole outfit and it fell in the river. That was it. It sunk before George could get at it. So we had to put a piece of plywood in to fill the hole for a few trips. And other than that, it was a pretty good operation down there.
Who ran the flying part of the operation, flying school part of the operation?
Well, we eventually got a couple in, a man and wife, Don and Ron Connolly, and she was an instructor.
Right.
And she ran the school for us. And then I guess before that, we got Lloyd Rumpfo up to run the school.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an instructor. Vancouver. Don and Ron were from Calgary.
So Lloyd Rumpfo, he left you, and then what did he do?
Well, we sold the outfit after George was killed. We sold Pacific Western Airlines.
Right.
And he bought, and Pacific Western Airlines wanted to get out of the Class 4 charter business, so mm-hmm. he bought that from Pacific Western.
Class 4 charter business.
Class 4 charter business.
Being,
I forget the weight limits, and it was up like the fleet Canuck and
small in charge.
Yeah, small aircraft. Charter, yeah.
Okay.
And then he eventually got a 180 and eventually a Beaver. And he sold his outfit, retired.
What did he call his outfit?
Yukon Airways, I believe.
Was there one part of the running operation which was the most difficult, the most problematic,
I think the most problematic was the red tape and the bureaucracy of the Department of Transport. They always, you know, had some ideas, which some were good and others were oddball, and they come up every so often unexpectedly and check you out. And of course, the biggest problem, I guess the main problem, was what they call the JIPO operators. Non-licensed people just come in and start flying and in the summertime, mm-hmm. and they call them chisel charters.
Mm-hmm.
They'd steal your passengers away and stuff like that. And they didn't have anything. They didn't have a hangar. They didn't have an engineer. They had nothing. They just nip in and take some of the gravy and then take off. And they're hard to find, hard to catch. And, of course, the Department of Transport come in. We were easy to catch. We were always there, always available. And so we used to have a few arguments with them, you know. I said to them one time, the inspector, why don't you take off after these JIPO charter operators? Why you bother us? We're trying to run a legitimate outfit. He said, that's why. You're easy to check. We can't get at these other guys. So,
when a quote JIPO operator arrives in town, you at the airport can spot them fairly quickly.
Oh yeah, we spot them. But then, you know, you don't like to go and squeal on somebody, and you couldn't really prove anything. I mean, you could see somebody taking some passengers and something. As far as you knew, he was just giving them a lift, doing them a favor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you couldn't find out whether he charged or what he charged or anything like that. So they're pretty hard to catch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was there a, I don't know if you want to call it an easiest part, but a most enjoyable part of the operation? Flying service days.
I guess the most enjoyable part was when everything was running well and there were no particular crises, and the aircraft were making a dollar or two and returning from trips. And when they're overdue, things get a little tense. And we had a local insurance agent, and he just about had a conniption fit. And that one week when we started out with five aircraft, and we ended up with one at the end of the week, so sold a couple and bust a couple and. One was missing.
So just to recap, your aircraft at the start of that week were...
Well, we had
BXH.
Yeah, BXH, we had Stinson Station Wagon, and we had FHA, the Beaver, and we had a Super Cruiser.
Right.
And Fleet Canuck, I guess.
Right.
We sold the Canuck and we sold the Super Cruiser. And we wrecked the Stinson, and we wrecked the 71, and George was missing with the Beaver.
Mm.
He'd run out of lake and charged up into the bush at this prospector's camp.
Right.
And couldn't get it back in the water until Pat Collison flew by and saw him down there and went and picked up some other chaps around the country and flew them in, and they basically manhandled it back into the water.
What was the lake that was at?
Fuller Lake.
Fuller Lake.
Yeah.
Now, why anyone? And then, so as I understand it, just around the time when George Milne crashed in the Beaver, you were already planning to sell to Pacific Western. Why was it that Whitehorse Flying Services decided they would sell?
Because it was. The company was poorly put together. It was a young lawyer who meant well, but he was just fresh out of law school. His name was George Van Roggen. He later became a senator. He died a few years ago. But he put the package together where we were all part of the company, and he didn't have any buyout clauses, you know, with pre-established prices and anything like that, so that the harder George and I and Bud worked, the more these guys we're getting rich, sort of thing.
Mm.
So we decided that, look, we'd better sell the thing and start over again. And so Pacific Western came after us, and so we said, okay, let's let her go. And
so
time George was killed.
And the aircraft you had when you sold to PWA, you had...
We had FHA and GCY.
GCY being that Beaver.
Another Beaver. And I forget the registration of the 180.
Cessna 180 anyway.
Yeah. And I think that's all we sold. We sold the Oronca sedan to the fella in Nuvik. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I guess we just had the three airplanes.
Right. And what kind of operation was PWA in 1955?
Well, they of course, they weren't operating out of Whitehorse. That's one reason they wanted to buy us, because we had the operating licenses for the Whitehorse base.
Right.
They were enlarging. They came out of Fort St. James originally with Russ Baker,
mm-hmm.
and they ended up picking up two or three of the outfits out there and ended up with Queen Charlotte Airlines and BC Airlines and three or four of those outfits, and so they picked us up as well.
Right. Who were you negotiating with at Pacific Western? Who did you cut the deal with?
Yeah, I don't remember. Oh, I think it was Rusty Harris was the one that we were working the deal with, although Russ Baker got involved in it. He knew our operation a little bit.
And so did you just sell them your aircraft and equipment, or did you sell the company?
I sold the company
to them.
Yeah.
And you stayed on with Pacific Western.
Yeah.
Did any of your business associates?
No.
No. So what was your role with Pacific Western?
Well, I was, I guess, until they sent a fellow up, Sandy Welburn, to take over as general manager. I was just operations manager, I guess,
mm-hmm.
at the time. And they sent up another Beaver and a Junkers and Anson. So we ended up with a fair number of airplanes.
What was the, where did the Junkers come from?
Well, they had it in Vancouver, as far as I know. It was,
remember the registration?
DXF, I think it was. I'm not positive on that, so you'd have to look in the albums.
And the Anson, do you remember where that came from?
Mm-hmm.
Did they stay here long, the Junkers and the Anson?
Not too long. I think just one season,
right.
Summer season. The Junkers was on floats. And then they sent us up a beautiful, fairly new Beaver. ICK was the registration of that.
Mm-hmm.
It had belonged to Queen Charlotte Airlines had bought that.
And what was the work that the company did? Was it bigger work then with the more aircraft?
No, it was just more charter work.
Mining, I suppose?
Yeah, I think the Anson, I think it was used. I'm not sure. It might have been involved in the tungsten operation,
right.
North of Watson Lake.
Right. How long did you stay with Pacific Western?
Oh, about about a year.
And then what?
Yeah, then I so it was then I went out on my own.
Sorry, you say your dad was running hard to
Yeah.
Volkswagen?
Yeah, and I I was out of for a while. I was with Northern Metallic Sales.
Right.
Now that started in my backyard in the garage. And I had six tires and eight or ten boxes of rags. And that was the start of Northern Metallic Sales.
And the Whitehorse brand. after that, then
you... And I went out on my own as Glacier Aircraft Repair and Overhaul.
Did you buy that from somebody, or...?
No. I had started up on my own. And there just wasn't any aircraft around. You know, wasn't enough aircraft around to keep busy. I did a little bit of work, but pretty soon I ran out of it. You know, I did a Beaver repaint, refinished, and top overhaul, and a Super Cub, and
did you haul some aircraft out of the bush?
Yeah, I hauled a Super Cub out of Canal Road.
Remember which one that was?
And no, American.
Mm-hmm.
On his way up, his girlfriend with him, and then I hauled Herman Peterson's 180 out of Tulsacaw. He did a high-speed turnover, and Ron Conley's Beaver GYK, it had collapsed in the Pelly River. And so I took it apart, dragged it up to Ross River, and put it back on wheels on, and flew it out of there to Whitehorse, and then had a professional pilot pick it up and fly it to Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And I did some renewals of C of A's and that sort of stuff. But then Pat Collison came along and wanted me to go with Klondike Helicopters because he was selling the business. And the fellows that he was selling it to were just buying it as an investment. They were accounting and finance types in Vancouver. So I said, okay, but you got to buy my little operation here, which didn't amount to a hill of beans. And he said he would. And so I went with Klondike. Down to Dawson, spent a summer down there in Dawson, then we moved the whole operation up to my shop in the hangar in Whitehorse.
So you sold to him, it sounds like, roughly the spring of the year, and
mm-hmm.
and then you went to Dawson and worked there for
the summer.
The summer season.
Then I went that fall, that winter, I went down to the helicopter factory in Palo Alto and got my engineer's certificate on the helicopter.
Which was that?
Hillers.
Hillers, okay. So when you arrived in Dawson that summer, what aircraft did
Pat
have?
He had four Bell G2s, I believe,
mm-hmm.
and two Hillers. And then he got two more Hillers. He ended up with eight machines, and then he sold to the name of the outfit in Calgary.
In the 60s.
Yeah.
So
in the meantime, I had been, I got a call from Ottawa and asked if I'd take over as commissioner.
Right.
And,
right.
So then I got out of it. However, they'd call me once in a while, ask me to haul gas or something like that down to Tesman or Watson, whatever it was.
You're
the 180.
So you're the commissioner of the Yukon, and they phone you up once in a while to fly the 180 to someplace.
So I just tell my secretary, tell people I'm tied up for the day.
Did you ever do it?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Not often, but once or twice. The 180 I'd been flying for Klondike, so I knew the airplane well.
Right. So when you arrived in Dawson that first summer to work with Pat Collison, what were you doing with them?
I was the in charge of engineering, and I was his operations manager, actually, because then come fall he left the country, and
mm-hmm.
I ran the operation while he was away.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, during the summer, he and I'd go out, visit the different places where they had helicopters,
mm-hmm.
work on them and do this.
So you moved down to Dawson that fall, and so you were the operations manager in, sorry, you moved from Dawson to Whitehorse that fall, and you were the operations manager in Whitehorse.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you, so they had a split operation then, or they had two bases, I guess?
No, everybody moved on Whitehorse.
So this was their base of operations then?
That's right.
Klondike helicopters. Right.
They also kept their base in Dawson, but there was nothing there in the wintertime.
Oh, okay. I see. And is there any winter business for helicopters? Were there in the late 50s? Or?
Very, very little. Very little.
So it's
practically not in the helicopter.
So what do you do then as an engineer?
Just overhauled. Well, we overhauled it. Overhauled in the winter.
Right.
Overhauled the machines. And lined up contracts for the summer flying.
Can you compare the two helicopters and their use in the Yukon? I mean, the Bell G2,
the
Bell 47 G2, and the Hiller. What model Hillers were they?
12Es.
12Es. How do they compare?
Well, the 12E was more of a workhorse. It hauled bigger loads and higher altitudes, but it was higher maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
A lot higher maintenance. The 47 was a real good machine. It was easy to maintain, and it was very reliable. So they each, you know, they were very close, in performance. But it was up to the customer. The customer would say, "Oh, well, I want this, or I want that."
Mm-hmm.
So you'd supply whatever machine he wanted, you know. And later on, they got. That's why, you know, the guys now, they're. Some guy, in order to bid on a job, they had to have a 205. Well, and, or they want a Hughes 500. A lot of people definitely want a Hughes 500. They were very fast and bloody good load carrier, but not too high maintenance. I didn't have much to do with them, but Bob and Dean had a lot. Air North, their helicopter company, had a couple of Hughes 500s.
Mm-hmm. Trans-North,
yeah.
Okay. So, I guess, on field operations? Or?
Well, I went out the start of one season and 12E because the fellow that was supposed to go out hadn't shown up.
An engineer.
And so I went out just for 10 days or so until he came in. When I got out there, it was a 21-man camp, and the cook had failed to show, and that was a serious thing.
You can do without an engineer, but not a cook, eh?
So I said, well... I said, I won't put up with any complaints, but I said, I can boil water and maybe get you by. Would you do that with the chief of the survey? I said, okay. So I cooked. I made cakes and cooked roasts and did everything like that. Nobody complained, but I see they were kind of looking a little pale at times. Anyway, I did that. And then the fellow that came in, he wasn't an engineer, but he was an apprentice. And he took over, and he... took over as a cook that year,
mm-hmm.
and they paid him separately aside from working on the helicopter. So did very good. Later on, he got his engineer's license, and he eventually went out. He married a school teacher up there. He went out to Kuala Lumpur and worked on helicopters, and he came back over into Calgary and he set up Eagle Helicopters, I think it is. He bought a couple of wrecks from the bank. Rebuilt them, leased them out, bought another one, did that, and I think he ended up with 12 or 15 of them. He never had pilots. He didn't send wet leases. He leased them out dry, and he became a millionaire in a very short time. And
he was aviation business.
Yeah, he sure was. Mel O'Reilly, he was a